Hey everybody, it's Kevin from the Wait What If podcast. I don't know if you can tell by my voice, but I have been sick as a dog over the past, gosh, it's been like a month. I got just some sort of cold thing that sort of ran its course, and then on top of that, I got the flu, and it just kicked the living shit out of me. I haven't been this sick in a long time. I spent days and days in bed, and then finally, and you know what? Whatever. I've been sick, but I've been kind of out of the loop. I really haven't worked on anything. Haven't worked on my Better Off Med channel. I haven't done anything. I've just been miserably sick and trying to get better. So, with that said, I'm attempting to get this podcast out because it's been about 3 weeks since my last episode. We did the Halloween episodes, and I think they went pretty well, and we had a couple back-to-back shows, so I could afford to take a few weeks off, but now I gotta get back into it, because actually I miss it. I enjoy the Wait What If podcast. So before we begin, Wait What If podcast is brought to you by We Are Dappertize. Check out wearedappertize.com. If you use the promo code What If at checkout, you'll get free shipping. Each tie is $15, and then there's $5 for shipping. The $5 for shipping will be taken off if you use the promo code What If. We Are Dapper Ties make some really cool ties. If you guys wear ties, if you dress up, you know, I don't know, for work or whatever, if you like to wear ties, check them out and support the show because you'll get a good product and you'll help me continue this wonderful thing that we call the Wait What If podcast. Today's episode is with Hans Fex. He's been on the show before. I suggest looking back or go to waitwhatif.com and just look back at some of the past episodes and you'll find it. I have no idea off the top of my head. It was like last year, so I don't know, somewhere in the 30s of the episodes. Take a look there. But he is the owner of minimuseum.com. I don't know really what to say. I mean, you'll hear us talk about it in the show. The Mini Museum is like this square piece of epoxy that has all these tiny little specimens that are really, really cool inside them. Things like space gems and samurai swords, Dracula's castle sand, which is what we're about to talk about today. So Hans, we chatted last year, and nice guy. We had a good time. I'd like to say he's become a friend just through the magic of the internet, just the fact that we've chatted and we've shared a lot of time together, just really talking through interviews and stuff. And last year he had this fantastic story about how he went to Dracula's castle, and it was a really good story, so I invited him back this year to tell it. Now it's this episode is more just us kicking back and chatting, so I'm going to try a different approach, and what we're going to do is I'll interject a few, I guess, to give you a little background on what we're talking about, and then I'll let Hans tell the story. So it'll be kind of like NPR style formatting here. Very different, but what the hell? Might as well try it out.
You're listening to the Wait What If podcast.
So like I said, Hans was the curator, I guess I can use the term curator, the developer, the mind behind minimuseum.com. So the story of where Minimuseum came from started with, I guess we could call it some personal tragedy. Hans worked for a company called Think Geek, and it wasn't so much the company that he worked for, but the friends that he worked with.
I was working with people that I loved working with, and it was the first time that I was working as a professional toy designer. Mm. So in that way, it was wonderful. It's a dream because of the people I got to work with. Okay. I mean, I've done other things, and when I work with people I really like, you know, that are really wonderful, I just have such a great time. So that part of it was really, really great. But now I'm working with those people still. They're here in the office, not right now, because it's after hours. But But so yeah.
So the idea of the Menu Museum came from childhood, really. Hans's father was a scientist, and Hans had seen his father do some things that gave him the spark to create the Menu Museum.
But the way I got the idea for it was that it was like 1977, I think it was, something like that. And then my father had returned from a trip, like you said, from I think it was Malta. And he brought with him a little a shell and some little pieces of stone, and he embedded them inside of a resin and epoxy. And so from that idea, from him doing that, I thought of the idea of the Mini Museum.
Yeah, and now you're on your third iteration, Mini Museum 3, and that's fantastic.
You're right, yeah.
So did you ever think that this idea would take off the way it has?
Well, I've been really thinking about it for a long time, and I mean, I thought it would be pretty popular. I mean, you know, one meets a lot of people who one just kind of gets to know people and see what their interests are, and maybe not as popular as it is right now. Maybe not doing the third one, that it still sells very nicely and people are still excited about it.
Sure.
But I thought the first one was going to be very exciting. I just didn't imagine then doing that interest would keep going and growing. That I didn't see.
So finally, Hans realized his dream and started Mini Museum with a team of friends.
Usually there are 9 of us here, mm-hmm. and we all kind of wear different hats. But basically, in a nutshell, there's Willie, who does spreadsheets. Jamie does pretty much everything. Right now, he's working on the web page for something that we're going to introduce. So yes, we've only done mini museums, but now we're going to be introducing a new product. And Jen's working on that product right now. And then there's Bill, who works on many different specimens, but currently he's working on Fordite. So in this room I'm talking right now, normally there's a lot of background noise, but I turned everything off because the tumblers, the rock tumblers.
Okay,
and so
great.
So there's the Fordite, and then there's Stephanie, who's usually here doing customer service, also working on specimens. Her husband Grant, he's also working on specimens. There's Andrea, who's also working on specimens. She's right now working on the 15th century samurai sword specimen. Okay. And then there's Chip, who's here on the weekends, but he's working on specimens, but he's gone right now.
What's it like to have all these specimens, only to break them up into tiny little pieces?
Well, some of the things, fortunately, already are very broken up. Like one of our specimens, San Andreas Fault, that's two different, that's a split fault line, and there's different colors of earth on each side of the fault line. But the samurai sword, it took us a long time, many years of couple of years of research, and then the right people to get this from, where it's really sanctioned from this society in Japan. And this early one had several errors all over it. It's never been used probably as an actual violent sword, because it had so many faults in it. Or maybe these things happened through time, and then people tried to do different repair jobs on it. And I don't know if it was used as an example to for repairs, as an example for what things can go wrong with it, whatever. But anyways, it is a samurai sword. It's from the 1300s, or 1400s. Extremely painful to take apart.
Right.
I mean, there are so many things here that are it's very difficult. I mean, this is one sword, and there are millions, or at least thousands, tens of thousands of these swords.
Okay.
Probably much more than that. And this one was in really bad shape. And again, it could never be used in practice or any in like a tournament or even in play. You can't take this thing and swing it around because it could break any second. A lot of people, collectors, have these, and they have ones that are in excellent condition. Mm-hmm. And this one was not. But still, it's something amazing, and it's something so incredibly beautiful. So yeah, it's very difficult. Everything that we actually take apart, it's usually what we do is we have one item. It's pretty much like one person's collection. You know, it's one sword that we use for all of the mini museums. We use one Viking axe. There are, and again, there are just hundreds of thousands of Viking axes. Many of them, probably most of them, still waiting to be found. The one that we used in the mini museum was one of probably thousands that were discovered during the Second World War when they were digging trenches all throughout Europe. And then what they would do is they find these rusted pieces of axe, and they had to repair them or kind of add a lot of iron to them. And then what we had to do is we had to remove all the modern iron till it was just down to the bare old original iron, and then work from that, which was really not much left in, right, in this original Viking axe. But yeah, no, it's horribly painful. But at the same time, you get one broken up Viking axe, or you get one the samurai sword is in very poor condition, and we get to share it with like thousands of people.
Is there an ulterior motive to breaking up these items so you can share them with more people?
Yeah, I think that there will be people who are inspired by, they'll be having a mini museum, or their friend will have a mini museum, and they'll see this little bone from a dire wolf or something. And that might inspire them then in life to do something interesting, or just to think interesting thoughts, even if it's later when they're going to go to college and they think to themselves, yeah, I remember this mini museum and it had a piece of the dire wolf in there. You know, that's such an amazing creature. And there was this little piece of it in this mini museum that was broken off of an originally larger bone. And it makes me so mad. So I'm now working in conservatism. You know, I'm conserving, things like that. So so either way, I'm hoping to inspire people to, one way or another, do good things on this planet.
Now, putting together the mini museum has taken Hans all across the world to really, really interesting places.
The first thing I think of is not the places so much as the people that I've met. And the way, just talking to many different people who are like paleontologists or archaeologists, and then just the situations that I'm in. But I think one of my favorite times was really talking to a friend of mine, Gary Olson, and he's in South Dakota, and there at his dig site, and it's just amazing being at a dig site. In my area. In Virginia here, there's not dinosaur dig sites, although there are dinosaur bones and amazing dinosaur footprints. Actually, a friend of mine found an incredible set of footprints over in Maryland, over by College Park. Just
really?
Stunning.
I didn't know.
Found many, but this is going to be a very famous set of footprints. It's not yet announced, and when they announce it, it's incredible. It has footprints from theropods, from sauropods, from pterosaurs. It has little footprints of mammals, and they're all footprints inside of in like, basically it's all their poop. It's just
nice.
Poop. It's fossilized poop and riverbed and whatever. It's just a mess, but it's an amazing. You'll see beak prints from the pterosaur inside there, and so on. So even just College Park, Maryland, is a great adventure for me when I'm with the right person, or the Badlands of South Dakota, and when I'm there with Gary Olson. But I mean, yeah, I've Australia with my friends Tom and Hank, having a great time over there with them. Again, collecting specimens. The adventures are really fun. I always thought about the places I'd go in the world as being really exciting, but it really ends up being the people I'm with, the company. When you're sharing that company on an airplane, or when you're talking with different people on your podcast, I mean, it's like you can be an armchair traveler, or even when you are traveling, it ends up being that the people you're with are what makes it.
The reason why I wanted to talk to Hans during this interview was his trip to Dracula's castle. It is a fantastic story, and I'll let him kind of just guide us through this theater of the mind, if you will.
On that trip, I was a delirious mess.
Okay.
I was super stressed because I was running out of money, and I had not been working for a while. And I hadn't slept very much at all for several days because I was way behind on certain things at home and then going on this trip. And so the trip, I could only go on for 2 days. I only had, I arrived there in the morning and then I was going to drive right up to this place to pick up a specimen and then drive back the next morning and then work on sterilizing the specimen and then spending one good night sleeping, getting up in the morning and then leaving.
Did Hans have a motive to collect this stuff and interesting stories at the same time?
No. I mean, it's just one of those fun, inspiring things. This is kind of, in a way, it seems more lowbrow. But, you know, the thing with what I like with the Mini Museum is there's all kinds of things in there that will get you thinking in different ways and in different levels. And I just really thought that soil from Vlad the Impaler. I think he can be called Vlad Tempest, but really Tempest means impaler in Romanian. So Vlad the Impaler, being then Vlad Dracul, the Order of the Dragon, Vlad Dragon. Although today Vlad Dracul means Vlad the Devil in modern Romanian. But at that time, he was Vlad Dragon, or Vlad the Third. One just reads a little bit about him. Or just as soon as you pull up any kind of Google search or anything about him, you start seeing these horrific images. He was good at terrifying people and scaring his enemy.
So you kind of became a Vlad the Impaler or a Dracula expert during this trip.
I've never spoken about him with people. But, I mean, he lived in the 1400s, and he was a prince of this area, which I guess was part of Transylvania back then, Wallachia or something like that is what it was called. And he built a castle that he then could watch from, and he was reigning there trying to keep enemies from coming into that area and taking over that area. So the place he decided to have a castle built was on top of the ruins of an already older castle. And then he decided to have that vantage point up there to be able to watch to make sure that the Turkish people wouldn't come in or different people wouldn't come in and take over his area.
Okay.
He was basically a guard.
Yeah.
You know, guarding this one front.
So at one point, things went sideways for Vlad the Impaler and things got really dark.
There's so many crazy things about him. I mean, I don't know where to start and where to end, but basically I'm going to continue with the way the castle was built.
Okay.
So what happened was, is this castle, he decided to have this castle built up there so he could go ahead and live up there and see from that knife edge kind of part of the mountains there, he could look out. And so To build the castle, he had a party where he invited the children of the aristocrats to come there, or the wealthy to come there. Mm-hmm. And so all these kids are there, all these children are there to have a dinner, and they had this incredibly lavish dinner. This is in the history books of the written at the time.
Okay.
And they enjoyed the festivities very much. And when it was time to go home, it wasn't time for them to go home. He now enslaved them, these children, to build his castle, to go down the mountain. It's a very steep mountain, and just pick up heavy rocks down there and bring them up and build this castle. And when they were done, they weren't allowed to change clothes. They weren't allowed to. They were, you know, fed very poorly, treated very poorly, and the ones that survived, and not many did. But the ones that did survive were allowed to finally go home. And when they got home, they found their parents were gone. The parents had been killed that night when they were having dinner. So there's other stories of where he would line the streets for miles of where every few steps one takes, there's another pole sticking up from the side of the road with a person impaled on it, an army that tried to invade and he's now putting them up as statues along the road to show what he does to his foes.
And how did this turn out for our friend Vlad?
He was eventually cut into pieces at the end of just before the 1500s, the end of the 1400s. He was just chopped up. And then recently they dug up where they believed he might be buried in some church or a castle or something. I think it was a church. And they lifted the stones where he was supposedly buried, and underneath they did find bones, but it was the bones of horses and probably not his bones. Hmm.
So if you're following the story, Hans is a stranger in a strange land. This is the Eastern Bloc. He's in a rental car. He doesn't really know where he's going, and he wants to find Dracula's castle.
Coming from the city, or just outside the city, the suburbs of the U.S., and coming over there and Bucharest, when I first got there, I went in. I think I must have reserved the car beforehand. That's what I usually do.
Okay.
But I can't remember if I was recommended to just wing it. But I figured, okay, if I can't get a car at the airport, I'll go ahead and go into town or something like that. But anyway, I got a car there. It's just like any other place in any other airport, you know, getting a car. So I got a car. I specifically asked for a Romanian car, and then I wanted a GPS. They didn't have a GPS. And I brought a GPS with me that had maps from all over the world except Romania. So now I had no GPS.
Yeah.
And I'm driving out in a general direction I think is right. And I stopped. There were some people I asked questions of, and people are so ready to help. So they're extremely approachable there. It's a very homogenous kind of an area. I mean, people there are all kind of struggling to get by. I mean, not everybody there is struggling to get by, but there's a lot of people struggling to get by, and you need each other out in the countryside, especially. You really need each other. It's houses are spaced very far apart from each other, and the winters, you know, it's a brutal place. I mean, I could drive for hours and never see a hospital, a police station, or really any recognizable business. It's just house and then a distance. And then a house, and then a distance, and I didn't barely see cars. I saw donkeys and wagons, mules and wagons, and even that was rare. But anybody I saw was wonderful. Everybody I met were super nice. The houses, they're like out of a movie. I mean, it's like going back, not Bucharest, not the city, but when you leave the city and all the way between Bucharest and going to Vlad the Impaler's castle, you're like, it's like being in Virginia where I live, but in the 1800s, mid and early 1800s. But people are super nice. They're all, yeah. So I thought it was absolutely wonderful. There's no street signs except in the city, but otherwise there's only one street sign where the street begins and maybe one street sign where the street ends. But if you're fortunate, there will be a street sign on both sides or one side or something. But no, houses were very happy the way they were built. The architecture was really good, really fun, really experimenting. The food to me was like, it was like eating in Sweden or Hungary or something like that. It was very similar. It was a happy place, I think.
And finding Dracula's castle isn't as easy as you would think.
Unfortunately, by the time I got there, it was pitch black. It was dark. It was late at night. It was like I think it was around 11 o'clock at night, and it was cold. And there I saw the lights of this hotel. Looks like a very nice hotel, and then there's this giant power station just beyond the hotel, and then the power station lights up against this mountainside, but the castle, which should be up there to the right, way up in the sky there on the top of that mountain ridge, it's just dark. I can't even see where the mountain ends and the sky begins. It's that dark. I'm exhausted. I haven't slept. And also another thing that I had at the time was I didn't realize I had different kinds of food allergies that I'd had for years since I was 12 or at least, but they got worse and worse and worse. And at this point, they were so bad and I didn't know what it was. I just knew I was sick from something. Yeah. So I'm delirious in many levels. And I know I'm not scared of any darkness or anything like that. No, I'm not scared. The only thing I'm thinking is I've got very little time. I want to get up there to that castle tonight and get silt and such from the floor of that castle. And I want it as soon as possible. That's all I'm thinking.
I need some advice to get up there. So I go into the hotel. I get my room and I put everything there. And then I go back downstairs and I go to the restaurant. They have a little restaurant and I eat outside. So I'm eating outside. It's cold, but I want to sit outside. I think I'm the only person sitting outside, and it's late and nobody else is eating, I don't think. So I'm sitting out there at the table and I'm looking up where it should be. And I ask the waiter to point, and they point, and I really work with them to really get an idea where that castle is up there, because I can't see it. So it's just in space. And I have a meal. It was delicious. Looked like something that Vlad would have eaten, but it, you know, looks, like I said, looks Hungarian or Swedish to me, so I'm used to that kind of stuff, and it tastes that like that too. It was very good, and so I say, okay, great. Well, is one allowed to go up there? And they said, yeah, you can go up there anytime. It's 24 hours. You can go up there. And I said, okay, great. Well, I'm just going to go up there right now. So how do I get there? And they go, whoa, you can't go up there right now. There's bears out there and there's wolves out there. They're all over here. And I thought, wow. And for just a moment, I'm delirious. Just a moment, I think, okay, well, that does sound terrifying. But then I realize, wait, that's got to be just some sort of a thing they say, because it sounds amazing and it sounds frightening and it's just part of the legend. So I went up to my room real quick to just get my backpack and make sure that I've got all the containers inside there to put the silt in and such. And then I decide, okay, I'm going to go ahead and read this little tour guide thing, which I've not read, the tour book. And I open it up to this area and talks about this area, and sure enough, it does say that the countryside of Romania is one of the most condensed and concentrated areas of bears and wolves in the whole of Europe.
Nice.
Gosh. And basically in the whole world, it's one of the most concentrated areas. I think that's incredible. I just can't even imagine this. But you know, it really is far out there. It actually, this castle is, but it's still out in the middle of nowhere.
Okay.
And I have not seen hardly any cars passing. So popular road and popular road. It's not.
So picture it. Hans is in a foreign country. It's dark. It's rainy. He's delirious. He's sick. And he's working with a sense of urgency. Now, I don't know where he gets the sense of urgency, but apparently he really, really needed to get to the top of this mountain that night while it's raining.
I think, well, I gotta go. I gotta go right now. I gotta get this thing, the soil. And I fell asleep.
Okay.
And I'm totally delirious, and I fell asleep. Anyway, I woke up only about an hour or two later. It's like just past midnight or just around midnight when I wake up. And now I'm feeling really screwed up from just sleeping very little after not sleeping for a few days. And I run downstairs out of the hotel as fast as possible. I get out there and there's this loud, it's just pouring buckets of rain at this point. That's actually why I woke up. It was just so much rain outside my window. My room is the size of a closet, actually. You almost have to fold that bed to get it into that room. But anyway, it was just an incredible noise. I woke up right by the gutter system, which is just pouring overflowing. So I run downstairs, I run outside, and I think I see a light over by the roadside there, where just below the castle. I mean, it's many hundreds of feet below the castle, but it's down in the road. And sure enough, there's a car there. And there's some tourists that were there from Romania, these kids. I think they've just been at they've been in a nightclub and they decide to come down and then go up to this castle, which they've never done before. But now when they're there, they're absolutely terrified of going there. And I said, hey, come on, we'll go together. And this guy was bigger than me. He said, no, I'm not going up there. There's like wolves and bears all over the place. I'm thinking, oh no, you know, I mean, he's serious. And, And I look over, sure enough, there's a sign there with all these warnings all over. Bears and wolves, do not go up here in the dark. And also, it's over 1,000 steps to walk up there. I'm just thinking, come on, I'll go with you. We'll all go together. And there's 3 other people in the car, and no one wants to go. And they get back. The guy gets back in the car, and he's soaking wet. He's just standing out there in the rain with me, absolutely soaking wet, gets back in the car, and they take off. Now I'm standing here, and I delve into my backpack, and I forgot my headlamp, which is my super wonderful waterproof headlamp, and I can't find it.
So Hans does what any rational person would do.
So I've got my backpack, and there's a hole in the forest there. I could see it when the car lights were there, and now it's just pitch black, and it's pouring like crazy, and I'm terrified that when I get up to the castle, the soil and silt and such will just all be washed away or soaking wet, so it's going to be impossible to gather. And anyway, I just walk in the direction where I saw the hole in the woods. So I'm walking straight ahead, and I can't see anything. And I can't hear if there's any creatures around in there because it's pouring rain. I mean, this rain was amazing. It's like, you know, mountainsides like this, when clouds, it can be perfectly beautiful, just moments you can be standing there and it's great. And then all of a sudden, these clouds on the other side of the mountain range, they just get kind of like squashed together, almost like a sponge full of water when it's going over the mountain. And then by the time they get over the mountain, it's just pouring rain. So I can't hear or see anything. I'm just feeling my way around, and I'm on steps. And then the steps keep turning different directions. I don't really know where I am. And I'm worried that I'm going to get turned around too much going up these stairs because I can't really follow them anymore. Mm-hmm. So I decide to just go straight up. And every time the steps stop, I just climb straight up. And eventually, I like climbing. I like free climbing. And actually, this trip was my last time I ever free climbed, seriously free climbing, because this just, I got freaked out from free climbing here because it was too much water, and the rock, I wasn't used to it. Some of the rock was really stable, some of the rock wasn't. But anyway, I just go straight up the mountain. Every now and then I get back on where there's a stairway, and then back up the mountain, back up the stairway, back up the mountain. And eventually, I get to this nice little ledge. It's the nicest ledge I've been on so far, where I just feel comfortable there, and I feel kind of safe for a moment, and it's not raining quite as hard, and I can kind of hear things around me. I just feel like, I think this is going to be okay. I think I'm just really getting close to the castle. It's got to be right up here, and it's going to be all right. And I'm really tired, but I'm feeling more clear than I've felt so far. And I feel in front of me, there seems to be another wall. This is just a straight up wall. Seems like it's going to be a little tough to climb this one. Maybe one of the toughest I've climbed so far, but it's got to be really close.
So this is where the story starts getting a bit strange. Starts.
And as I'm standing there, I start hearing voices from up above. And I make out this voice to be kind of like a man or an older boy, like maybe in his 20s or at least his 20s, and sounding very authoritative. And then I hear what probably, and he's to the left up above me. And then to the right, there's this younger boy, a teenager probably, and then probably his girlfriend or sister or something, or friend. And so I'm standing there thinking, okay, all I gotta do is climb up here. This is where the castle is. And where these people are, and it's still raining a bit, not much, and I'm thinking, but it's pitch dark, I cannot see anything, and I'm thinking, well, they sound really friendly, and like they're not sounding angry or anything like that. They don't sound vicious or mean. Their tone seems kind of nice. So I'm waiting there for about 20 minutes, not really knowing what to do. I'm really scared that I'm going to be in trouble for climbing up here in the middle of the night, that they're going to turn me away. Because I'm about to say to them, hey, hi, I'm here to collect some silt. Is that going to be okay from you guys? Because I can't do this without an okay from somebody.
Right.
Yeah. You know, this is the people who run the place,
And I, if they say no, then this is all over. So I'm waiting there and I just can't think of what to do. I'm scared that I'm thinking, what if they get angry at me for approaching in the middle of the night like this? Cause they're going to think, hey, wait, you want permission, but you're up here in the middle of the night. Cause my plan was get this stuff as much as possible and then keep on collecting it until, it's daylight and then go and tell because I think you had to buy tickets apparently or something like that. I don't know if I knew that beforehand or if I knew that once it was light or something. But anyway, I just wanted to then afterwards say, hey, is it okay if I take this stuff or do I have to go and dump it all back? And I was thinking maybe this isn't really good. This is probably, I don't know. Anyway, finally, 20 minutes later, I say to myself, all right, I'm just going to do this. I'm just going to climb up there. I'm just going to ask them. So I start climbing up and, I reach this where I think it's got to be the ledge because I can kind of, I feel this very kind of sharp area. And I think this must be like the ledge here. I just pull myself up and there's going to be a nice, safe place. And I'm going to hopefully be okay with these people. I'm not going to be too pissed off.
So I hope you're picturing this. Hans is climbing the side of a mountain. He's delirious. He doesn't feel well. He's tired. He's in pitch black. And he has this feeling that he's approached a void.
I pull myself up, and it hurts my fingers because it's a very sharp wall, kind of like that I'm pushing myself up on. And I get up, and this wind just hits me hard. I'm at the top, the peak of this mountain. I can't see a thing. I just have a feeling there's nothing there but a cliff that goes straight down. I've been spending 20 minutes at least listening to a conversation that I could almost understand. And there's nobody and nothing there. Wow. And I was utterly confused and didn't know. I just sat there not knowing what to do. It was one of the most confusing and I just wanted to fall asleep and just give up for a little while. I just wanted to rest and figure out what was going on. But what I figured out was that I reached down and put my hand around in different areas and really listened. And I really felt like this is a cliff. I'm on a cliff. And this just, so I had to turn around. I left something there. I can't remember if I left my pen there or something on purpose, but I left something there under some rocks a little bit, but so it was kind of poking out. And then I got down to the next part. And when I got to the next place I could stand where I felt there was a stairway, which was quite a ways down, it was a ways down. And also a little further to the right, if you're facing the mountain and up against it crawling up and you go about 30 yards to the right, that's where the stairway was that I finally met. But I also, it was way below the area that I was at. And I left something there as well, just as a marker. I couldn't see anything. I just thought, I'm going to come back here later when it's light and try to figure this out. Anyway, I just retraced my steps and just kept going down and down and down and down and down until I got to the bottom of this place. And then when I got to the bottom and finally came out of the forest, back to where I'd met those people who had come over earlier to go up the mountain. Now it's like 3 a.m. or something like that. Still pitch black. It's not raining anymore. And I thought, okay, I'm going to try this again.
So he's, again, top of the mountain, all alone. At least he doesn't think he's alone. Did he ever find the people? Or most importantly, any of the sand from Dracula's castle?
Well, I still have no soil. And now I'm really unhappy. I'm unhappy because I didn't really make it very clear about how I was listening to this conversation. But I mean, I was really trying to make out what these people were saying, and I couldn't hear a single real word, but it was so close. So at this, I was really screwed up at this point. I just felt really, really odd. And like you're saying, I don't believe in ghosts at all. I don't believe in spirits, and I certainly didn't believe in ghosts and spirits right now either. I just didn't at all. Mm-hmm. But it was very disturbing because I've had something similar happen to me about 20 years before, and that was in a house that was very well known to be haunted, and I was only one of four people in the house, and that was a very interesting story in itself.
Sometimes it's not, you know, an actual ghost. It's the frustration of not being able to explain something that drives us crazy.
Seeing something or hearing something that I don't believe in and that I can't explain, mm-hmm. I know there's an explanation for this. And I'm kind but you know, years go by and I get more and more worried that I'm never gonna live long enough to figure out what this is. And I don't like to tell this story to people. And I maybe told it to three or four people after I came back, you know, within the next year or so. And it was very uncomfortable because every one of them, I think, secretly believed that I probably did believe in ghosts, but I really didn't. I told them, one day I'm going to find out what this is. Anyway, so I decide, okay, I'm going to get up there to this castle. And in the history books, Vlad the Impaler's wife, she and him and a bunch of the guards were up in the castle, and there was an army coming for them. And Vlad's wife in the bedroom said something like, I'd rather jump out this window and fall into and die and rot in the river than be taken by whoever it was who was coming there. And she did. She jumped out the window and she did die falling off the cliff and into the river. So I felt like there must be a river around here somewhere. And it's probably, well, I remember actually from driving also up there, I did see it on the right side a few times. So I think it's the Argus River. And so I get to the river and I figure, okay, this place here is, if I go here up the mountain ledge, I will reach what used to be his bedroom, or at least part of it, or maybe not, but maybe the next room to where his bedroom was, because there was a time where in 1888, I think it was, there was a landslide and part of the castle fell down with that landslide into the river. So I don't know if his bedroom is still complete up there or not. But anyway, I decide I'm going to climb up this wall. And climbing up this wall, there's no way any bears or wolves or anything is going to get me now. So I felt that was maybe the safest move rather than going back to the woods and, you know, playing roulette with my life in the woods. So I start climbing this rock. This was one of the two worst climbs I've ever had, and I hadn't climbed in years, free climbed in years, because of my last lousy, stupid encounter. And before that, I'd had just great enjoyment of climbing, but just the last two times I climbed, I climbed some rocks that shouldn't have been climbed, and this was another one of those cases. But I'm just so headstrong, I'm just saying, okay, I'm just gonna keep going, and I kept going and going, getting down, going back down from here. I knew I couldn't do, like, I was not gonna be able to get down, go back down this way. So once I got up there, I had to find a better way down. I figured I'm just gonna wait till daylight when I get up there. But anyway, so I climb up and I do reach what is. Possibly, it's a small area for a room and a ledge there, and I do reach the window ledge and crawl into what is possibly his bedroom, or what would be his bedroom if it was on that floor. Of the room, there's no higher floors to it. If you look up Dracula's castle, you might find Bronn's castle, mm-hmm. or Bronn castle, which is beautiful. It's even spectacular. It's this huge, amazing castle on top of a mountain, and it's you look at it and think, wow, if there's a bed and breakfast there, I'd love to go there and take my family, you know, and things like that. But Vlad probably never went there, and if he did, there's no trace of it in the history books. This castle that I went to, Pinari Castle, is it's just ruins, and the brick that you do see there, most of it is not original. The brick that you will see pieces of that are actually from the mountain, those are probably original, and then there might be some original red brick there, but most of it's not. Anyway, so now I mean what I'm hoping is his room, which was either on the bottom floor there, or or unless his room was in a higher floor, which is gone now, or if his room was part of the landslide. But anyway, I get there. And and then eventually I find the person who runs the place and discuss things with him and tell him why I'm there and so on. And he let me absolutely take take these pieces of silt from that room.
Yeah. And after he heard your story, he's like, man, this poor guy.
No, he was very, very nice. No, I didn't tell him the story, but I did retrace my steps and I did find that I had climbed up to this knife edge of the cliff. If I had just swung myself over, I would have fallen straight down to the bottom, way down to the ground. It's just a cliff that goes straight down to the regular street level.
Oh my gosh.
yeah. I mean, there were several pine trees in the way, but it looked like where I would have fallen, I wouldn't have hit any of them.
Well, I was going to say, what's amazing about the story, as you're telling it, you could look at it as, hey, I was the guy that took all my equipment and decided to climb Dracula's castle in the middle of the night, or in the sense that it actually happened, you were so far out of your element that it's remarkable you made it. You had wolves, you had rain, it was the middle of the night, you were tired, you were sick, and yet you still underwent it. Actually, it tells me a lot about your state of mind at the time, and your commitment actually to your vision, to the mini museum vision.
Yes, that was really what I was committed to. I just really wanted to finish this project that I thought it was. I was in second grade when I thought of this project, and I just really wanted to get it done.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. That's a fantastic story.
Well, it's not quite over, actually.
Oh, okay.
There's a little bit left. Because it gets very interesting. This is actually the reason why I like telling this story, which I've not told very often, but I'm in my house, and which I still have, fortunately, thanks to everybody I'm working with here. And also thanks to everybody who buys the mini museum. I mean, I would have lost it. I almost lost my house, and that's also why I was so stressed when I was over there in Romania, because I really was just it's like every single piece inside the mini museum. It's like I just get this target fixation where I just, you know, I got to have it in there, and it's got to be the real thing. So I went there to get it, because even though I could have gotten in many other kind of ways, I could have asked somebody to send it to me. I wouldn't know if they really got permission from a person, and I wouldn't know if they really got the soil from the castle, or if they went to the wrong castle, or if they went to their backyard or something like that. It's just such a simple thing as Dracula's soil has to be real. So anyway, I'm in my house. I'm in my kitchen, and I'm doing dishes, and I'm alone, just as I am here right now in this office, and just as I was on the top of that mountain in Romania, and I hear a conversation starting. I hear it in my right ear mostly. It's over around the corner from the kitchen, over to the right, and then around that corner, in my living room. And I'm listening, I'm thinking, is that a radio that's going on? It's a conversation between two people. And I know I don't have a radio in that room. My phone is not in that room. There's nothing in that room I can think of that can make any sound, or certainly any talking sound. And I'm thinking, what is that? And I put down my dishes. After a while, I mean, I'm still doing the dishes. It's not like I'm not panicked or anything like that. But I'm just thinking, this is really odd. And I'm not afraid in any way. I feel very safe in my house. I feel very safe in my neighborhood, and I know whatever it is, everything's gonna be okay. And I put everything down, and I walk over. As I'm walking around the corner, the voices become clearer and louder, and I'm about to hear exactly what they're saying. And their voices become bubbly, and all I hear is bubbles, and watery bubbles. I'm thinking, what is that? And I look around the corner, and there is I'd just gotten it from my neighbors the week before. I'd gotten this really nice aquarium because they were moving. And almost immediately, I mean, really, it had to be as fast as any thought could be. I realized all those conversations those ghosts had were from the wind, were from natural sounds of the ambient sounds. I was so glad to find. I'm so glad to not die before finding out what the hell that was.
There's a name for that. I don't remember what it is off the top of my head, but I remember someone was telling me, or maybe I read it. I don't know. I don't know half the stuff that winds up in my brain, but I know that there's for that phenomena of hearing voice or hearing voices or conversation, and it turns out to be water or a door squeaking, there's an actual name for it.
Yes, and I forgot what that name is. I heard that name about a week after this happened to me, discovery. I was talking with someone over the phone about a specimen that I wanted to acquire from them, and then they actually were interested. They just mentioned, not even me telling them this story. I didn't mention the story. They just started talking about their interests and how they like making microphones and speakers and studying sounds. And they mentioned this name that you're thinking. And he also made a name that he'd kind of made up that sounded even better. And I wrote those words down and I put them on my aquarium in my living room.
Did you really?
Yeah, but I don't remember what those words are.
Yeah. Well, that's
yes, there is.
Wow.
Yes, there's the thing of finding patterns, either in audio patterns or in your brain or what you visualize. There are so many people that imagine things, like imagine seeing something. You look way down the street and you see some leaves there, but you really are sure that that's a dead squirrel laying there. But the person next to you will say, No, that's just some leaves. I can see why you think it's a dead squirrel, that twig sticking there, that leaf shape there, but I'm telling you, I can see it from here, it's leaves. And the other person's like, no, it's a dead squirrel and it's curled up its hands and its mouth is gaping in a terrorized look and its tail is all scraggly. You know, and then one person is right when they walk up there, but it's about that. It's like you see patterns or you'll hear patterns. And I didn't know I was like that because I've been so pleased with myself that I don't mistakenly see things or make things up in my mind, but I do.
Yeah, there's a, I don't know what the term is, I guess a comfort in, so like I said earlier, I understand why people believe in the supernatural and things like that. I understand that. I don't know if it's, you know, a need for that the idea of life to go on or whatever, but when you don't have that in your life, it simplifies things quite a bit. And it I don't know, I guess it just, just last week, actually it was last Monday, I did my first live broadcast. So my good friend down the road,
wow,
he owns a bar, and we set up, we used Facebook, and we were talking about technology early in this episode, but I live broadcasted a video ghost hunt. It wasn't really a ghost hunt. We just went through this guy's old bar and kind of highlighted the areas where he had these unexplained events happen. Some things caught on security camera. So there was some interesting stuff going on. And so I had organized like a ghost hunter, I guess, or a paranormal investigator and a psychic. And so what we did is we walked through the bar. You can see this on my website at waitwhatif.com. We walked through the bar and at each section, like Mike and Malia, those are the two owners, they would tell us about what happened. And then I'd go and talk to the paranormal investigator and he'd tell me what he was thinking. And then I'd go to the psychic and they would tell me. And it really gave me a good understanding about all the different ways you can take this stimuli that we have every day and interpret it in different ways. And I completely understand why anyone would interpret it anyway, from the skeptic's point of view all the way to the spiritualist point of view. I mean, it makes sense. But when you break it down to, I guess, science, it simplifies things and allows you to focus more on, I guess, concrete things. Which by no means is not meant to insult anyone who believes in the spiritual side of things. It just simplifies. Because believe me, I'm working my butt off on the concrete, and if I have to add in all this other intangible spiritual side of things, and man, that just triples my work.
Yeah, no, I think for you and I, it really simplifies things. But I think for people who believe in it, I think maybe it can really simplify things for them that they do believe in that.
Sure. And,
you know? Yeah. So I don't know if it just simplifies things for us, but I'm just really, really glad that I finally figured out what this was, since I don't believe in this stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm just so relieved. But
what's kind of cool, and this kind of goes back to your Meaning Museum, is now that story is there, you know, I hear this story, and with whether it's history, and I guess in this sense it is with history, when you read about a historical situation, it becomes fiction to you until you can actually touch it and become part of it, then it actually brings it to life. Well, I'm going to go look at my mini museum before I head to bed, because that little bit of Dracula Sand that I just looked at as, hey, Dracula Sand, now I feel like I'm part of the story that you just told. You know, you just told this great story about climbing up there, and you know, we're separated by, you know, we don't know each other besides on the I guess we can call this the social media world, but we have a connection now. The sand that you collected is in my living room, so I'm gonna go check it out before I go to bed.
Yeah, there it is. I had to originally I'd hoped to be able to put it in little glass vials, but instead the glass vials would either be crushed under pressure when I was casting, or the cork would get pushed in, because there's a lot of or different things would go wrong. So I instead made little coffin shaped.
Yeah, that was nice. I like that.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so it's minimuseum.com. Folks can go there and order the Mini Museum 3. Once they're done, right, that's it? Once you sell the last Mini Museum 3, then they would have to wait for the Mini Museum 4? Like, there's no way to go back to the 2 or the 1, I guess, unless you found it on Craigslist or eBay or something like that?
That's right. When they sell out, they're gone, and then you're right, they're only available on those places that you mentioned, yes. Yeah, yeah, like eBay or Craigslist, yep.
Okay. Well, if you're interested in one, check it out at minimuseum.com. Do you have social media? Do you have anywhere else you want to drive folks to, or is it just to your website?
No, that sounds good. I mean, if anyone's interested, and if it's sold out by the time they get there, they just put their email down, and we'll go ahead and inform them whenever there's a new one that's coming out.
Yeah, there's all sorts of, like, I think last year I told you that I got the chainmail and Neanderthal axe. And what was kind of cool is that my 40th birthday, my wife actually had those pieces put into a bracelet, like a leather bracelet.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. That's really neat.
So it was just sitting on my counter, and now I actually can wear it every day. Yeah, so I thought that
was cool. Wow, that's really, really nice. That's a great idea.
Absolutely. So lots of good stuff over there. Hans, thank you very much. That was honestly one of the top stories that I've collected so far in my little mini museum of stories.
Well, Kevin, thank you very much. I really loved your stories. I also really liked what you said. You know, I was thinking that maybe this will help people to realize when they hear something or when they see something, that there could be a reason for it, and they just might have to wait a long time to find out what that reason is instead of that it is something that's unreal. But I also really liked what you said, which was that when you do certain things in life, the one thing you're doing, just because you get yourself exhausted doing that thing or overtaxed doing that thing, doesn't mean that then spills over to the other thing that you're working on, that you're able to do these different things without the different things draining you from the other. I thought that was very, really impressive. Not many people are able to do that, and it's something that I'm still working on, and I'm not there yet. That's really great, Kevin.
It's amazing at where you can find time to do things. I mean, if like I said, I just keep biting off more, and until I bite off too much where I'm really like, I've got myself against a wall, I can't do anything else, I'm just going to keep doing it. In fact, we're working, well, whatever, if you'll see things on my Twitter, things that we're working on just for fun and spreading stories and having a good time.
I look forward to it.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you very much, Hans. I really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you very, very much. Have a good night and happy Halloween.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Like us on facebook.com/WWIPodcast and at WWIPodcast on Twitter. Drop us a line at waitswhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn Internet Radio. Enjoyed your listening experience. Now go forth and expand your reality.